My name is Michael McCusker. I just learned that the Astoria School Board voted last night against establishing a health center at Astoria High School. The vote was 3-2. And I am reminded by this act of the Kansas City School Board, which continues to deny evolution. Well, today, in this program, the year 1992, which was 21 years ago, plays a rather prominent part in what I'm going to read. And also what I'm going to read today, I wrote. So therefore, I'd like to give the disclaimer that what you are about to hear this next half hour is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in all of the dueling and duality cosmos. Well, today is the 9th of May, and Saturday, is the 11th of May. Don't know how I got Monday. And that's the day of discovery, 221 years since a small ship sailed into the, American ship sailed into the big river, which now is named Columbia, after that ship, May 11th, 1792. So I'd like to read something I wrote about it. And it's been revised from what I've written before, in case you've read it before or maybe heard it once or twice on this program over the few years. Start with a quote by Thor Heyerdahl, if anybody remembers him. He was the fellow that sailed Contiki out into the Pacific Ocean, and a new movie has just been released, sort of a dramatization of it, whereas he actually had a documentary that he filmed going into the Pacific. Europeans go around the world saying they are the harbingers of civilization, but it was Africa and Asia that civilized us in the beginning. Heyerdahl died in 2002. Before anything else, you must remember that when the American ship Columbus Reborn entered the river that bears its name in the robust spring of 221 years ago, a culture that vibrantly dwelled on both shores for maybe 20,000 years at that moment began to become extinct. The history we celebrate is our own cultural history. That which we supplanted has generally been ignored as insufficient, not worth popular study, until recently. Now, a few generations removed from their obliteration as hemispheric monarchs, we are interested in them. So new are we that we might be regarded as a pustule growing from the skin of a leathery 20-millennia culture that was decimated by its parasitic visitors. We know little of their history, assorted myths and a few bones to fill in the vast gaps of time in broadly general rather than individual narrative. And that was more or less a prologue. When Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, he thought he would have a straight passage west around the world to India and trump the competition by opening up the riches of Asia for his employer, the newly reestablished Christian monarchy of Spain. Instead, he bumped into a rock, and for 300 years, Europeans looked for a waterway through it, a passage west to the east that connected the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. Ever since the Crusades of the 11th and 12th centuries, Europe was hungry for the silks and spices of Asia. The Christian hordes were greedy for pagan wealth, but were unsuccessful taking it by conquest. The Saracens, as the armies of the cross called them, once they expelled the infidels, were more than happy to trade with them. Europe's gold and silver in exchange for Asia's silk and spice. For centuries, the only door to the east from the west, and vice versa, was through the narrow Mediterranean, the Middle Sea, and the merchants of Venice, who trounced their rivals Pisa and Genoa for virtual monopoly as go-between. In the 15th century, when Ottoman sultans ruled almost all of Western Asia and Eastern Europe, including the once magnificent Byzantine Empire, the first of the great Atlantic seafaring nations, Portugal, sent its small sailing ships to explore an end run around Africa to the rich ports of India and China. It took them nearly a century to round the Cape of Good Hope and sail into the Indian Ocean in 1498, 6 years after the great navigator collided with the Western Hemisphere. Columbus, who was an unemployed seaman from Venice's rival Genoa, first tried to convince the Portuguese that it would be easier to reach India by sailing west across the Atlantic Ocean. Spain, which had just kicked out the last of its Muslim North African conquerors and re-enfranchised its medieval monarchy, was anxious for global wealth and power after 7 centuries of foreign occupation, and hired Columbus, who, as it turned out, underestimated the Earth's circumference by half and had not calculated the presence of the American continents. Spain, though disappointed that India was not so easily reached after all, built a world empire on the riches of American civilizations it destroyed and the gold and silver it mined with the forced labor of incorrectly named Indians and black African slaves. England and France came late into the action of looting the Western Hemisphere, and although ancient rivals, each was determined to undermine the Spanish Empire. Each independently sought a passage through North America to Asia, primarily because Spain controlled the South Atlantic. Papal bull split the world between Spain and Portugal until the former consumed the latter. That would be papal, the Pope's edict. But Elizabethan seahawk Francis Drake got through the Straits of Magellan at the bottom of South America, and after raising a great fuss, sinking Spanish ships and sacking Spanish settlements, sailed up along what is now the Oregon coast, looking for the Pacific entrance to such a Northwest Passage in 1579. How far up he came and where he stopped to scrape his ship's hull is disputed, and almost every developer building a condo in a cove hires an historian to claim Drake landed there. Even the Nahalem River Valley is claimed to be Drake's new Albion. What is not disputed is that he sailed across the Pacific Ocean in a single ship, the Golden Hind, to get back home to England because fleets of angry Spanish were awaiting for him on his back trail. Drake was the first Englishman to sail around the world, 84 years after the Portuguese Ferdinand Magellan, who was killed in his attempt to girdle the globe, though 15 men of his expedition survived to complete the 3-year voyage in 1522. 9 years later, Drake played a major part in wrecking a large Spanish fleet that intended to invade England, called even today by sardonic Spaniards the Invincible Armada. That English victory in August 1588 began England's long rise to world power. Along the way, it colonized and lost a strip of Atlantic seacoast in North America to rebellious colonists who declared themselves a new nation and immediately set off to grab a large share of Asia's bounty for itself. Hopes for a Northwest Passage to the Pacific through North America faded over the centuries. Spain lost its lengthy supremacy, and ships from northern European nations took the long ways around Cape Horn and Good Hope. But a new legend replaced it. Now there was thought to be a great river of the West, which was said to be called by Native Americans the Oregon. People thought the Missouri River was navigable to the Rocky Mountains, and after a short portage, the Great Western River could be reached and traversed straight to the Pacific. But like the Northwest Passage, no one could find this great river. The great English explorer James Cook sailed past it in bad weather in 1778. But Cook thought the river was there. Just off the Columbia, he saw brown water puddling into the ocean like an oil spill. 10 years later, in 1788, another Englishman, John Mears, a freelance entrepreneur, tried and gave up, naming Deception Bay and Cape Disappointment to discourage others who might follow him. And George Vancouver and his royal expedition were just off the mouth of the river in 1792, but were deceived, as was Mears 4 years earlier, by surf breaking across the bar. The Spanish explorer, Bruno Heceta, thought he had found the river in 1775, which he named the San Roque. but was unable to get in because his crew was too weak from scurvy to man their ship across the tempestuous bar. In the spring of 1792, the same year Vancouver sailed past, on May 11th, an American from New England, Robert Gray, took his ship, Columbia Rediviva, which means Columbus Reborn, through the wild surf at the bar and entered the fabled river, which he named Columbia after his vessel and the great admiral of the ocean sea himself. Robert Gray has been rescued from obscurity. At least he is remembered every day of discovery. On his first voyage to the Pacific Northwest, 4 years earlier, in 1788, in another ship, Lady Washington, the same year Mears gave up on the great river, Gray sailed into what is now Tillamook Bay. Gray and his trading partner, the colorful and luckless John Kendrick, exchanged ships, and Gray set off across the Pacific in Columbia Rediviva to China to trade seal, otter, and beaver pelts bartered from Indians with cheap trinkets and glass beads, known as trader's beads, and returned to Boston. He and his crew were the first U.S. citizens to take the American flag around the world. It was on his second voyage to the Pacific Northwest, entering the Pacific Ocean as before through the perilous passage around Cape Horn, that Gray claimed discovery of the Columbia River, which, as a matter of note, would have astonished the people who lived along the river for thousands of years and knew about its presence all along. Gray stayed 2 weeks in the river. Afterward, he sailed a second time to China. Later that year, Vancouver, who had missed the river, sent one of his ships, Chatham, commanded by Lieutenant William Broughton, to explore the Columbia after he learned of Gray's claim. Broughton charted 100 miles upriver and named Mount Hood, locals called it Y East, after an aristocratic sponsor of Vancouver's Northwest Expedition. As a result of his work, Vancouver attempted to claim discovery of the Great River for himself and, of course, for England's King George III. Gray's claim, however, prevailed. When Britain and the United States bickered over territorial claims to the Northwest in the mid-19th century, the famous 54-40 or fight squabble, Gray's ship's logbook of his discovery was a critical factor that made Oregon and Washington two of the United States. Although Gray put an end to the search for a liquid thoroughfare through the Americas, along with an overland jaunt by Lewis and Clark in 1803-06, that started when Columbus found them in his way exactly 300 years earlier, a northern sea route between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans was navigated in the years 1903 to 1905 when Roald Amundsen of Norway sailed and drifted across the top of North America. And in 1969, the U.S. oil tanker Manhattan plowed a similar course through ice-clogged Arctic waters, accompanied by icebreakers. But, of course, the Panama Canal was built and has been operating since 1914 and is currently being deepened and widened for much larger ships. And jet planes fly around the world in less than a day, which mocks the hardships and deaths of early globe-girdling mariners who lived and died at the mercy of wind, water, and disease. This 13th year of the new millennium/century, the nations of the Americas commemorate the 521st anniversary of Christopher Columbus's first voyage in search of India. Some celebrate, others bitterly denounce the intrusion of Europe upon the Western Hemisphere and the consequences of half a millennium of conquest and epidemic. The intense eruption of controversy resembles the dispute between the intellectuals of the 18th century in which Rousseau, Voltaire, et al. Argued that the European discovery of the Americas had cost millions of lives and the wholesale destruction of native culture and was thus a blight upon the history of civilization. A similar, less controversial acclaim is paid Robert Gray and the bicentennial plus 21 years of his claim of discovery of the fabled River of the West on May 11, 1792. Yet the consequences have been a microcosm of all that Europe accomplished or ruined in this half of the world, this past half millennium. Almost immediately, white Americans and Europeans came in Gray's wake to trade, to settle, to supplant, and eventually eradicate native culture. The Great River has itself been tamed with dams, the massive forests on both sides of its banks logged and replaced with cities and farms, and the millions of salmon, which until only recently were so numerous it was claimed a person could cross the wide river on their backs, have dwindled to only an endangered few. The exchange of a natural wilderness for a human wasteland is relatively recent. The Pacific Northwest has been a last small corner for Western exploration, with the exception of the poles and Antarctica. Gray opened up a major portion of the last frontier, yet the annual celebration has less to do with his discovery of the Great River than it does the present and future generations of native strangers who dwell among the vanished ruins of a fatally vulnerable culture our predecessors overran. The present tenants of the Columbia River Basin inherit a legacy of raw exploitation and waste. The riches once so abundant have been despoiled, virtually all used up in only a few generations. Even the big river has not escaped the pollution of modern society, known as one of the most radioactive rivers in the world as a result of Hanford plutonium and Trojan nuclear waste, and it is a garbage dump for towns and cities along its banks. Industrial pollution is a major offender. The glacier at its source is melting, and its mouth is threatened with LNG tanks and coal export terminals. The present generation is bitterly divided about Gray's legacy, and each side of the controversy utilizes extremes in its arguments to exploit or preserve. On the one hand, it might be considered that a great civilization has reached its maximum westward movement on the North American continent in the Pacific Northwest. On the other are the extreme environmental damages which an expanding population and its technology have wrought upon the landscape. It is unfortunate that what remains of Gray's legacy is coveted by the nation at large, including the water of the river itself. It is likely that the decisions have already been removed from local say-so, just as likely a massive earthquake that is predicted for some time soon will rearrange the region into something very different. Hail, Columbia. And I'd like to read now sort of a personal epilogue. Astoria made a big deal out of the Day of Discovery bicentennial in 1992, which included a parade on May 9th, today, which was a Saturday that year. I was the announcer because my landlady, Carol McCafferty, was the parade's organizer and requested the use of my mouth as the parade's Betty White, if anyone remembers her perennial TV MC role at the annual Pasadena Rose Parade. The usual assortment of bands, cheering squads, fire trucks, and hordes of scouts of varied troop and gender were mixed with Indians from upper river tribes. It was Native American Day, and white men and women attired as frontier people and mountain fur trappers, black powder addicts who spend their holidays and vacations camping out and shooting old muskets. Two floats were in the parade, one a replica of the Columbia Rediviva from Gray's school, the other Tongue Point Job Corps version of Fort Clatsop. A cold, wind-driven drizzle goaded the paraders to move more rapidly along the route than planned, and a few entries were not in the order of appearance I was given to announce. The rain pasted the pages of the list to each other, and more than once I had to squint into the storm and try to identify whatever group was swiftly approaching the grandstand, which was crowded with wet and cold dignitaries who shed some of their dignity. Half-naked girls in a high school cheering squad were soaked and chilled by parade's end, and two courts of festival princesses, Rose and Scandinavian, riding in convertibles, were bedraggled when they passed the grandstand. Just before the parade started, a man asked if I was going to say something radical. I replied that police snipers on roofs across the street had orders to shoot if I did. I almost gave in to satire, however, when Fred Beaver danced and threw candy at kids, followed by the city's cultural export to the outside world, the Astoria Clowns, who seemed half-drowned as they gamboled past the grandstand, as well as tired from a parade in Seaside earlier that morning. The PA system I used to announce the passing paraders deafened people nearby the grandstand, but was barely audible less than a block away or across the street, which seemed to be where most of the spectators were, huddling inside store doorways or underneath awnings along the sidewalks. At the finish of the parade, I walked straight to a bar to warm up and dry off with coffee and brandy. 2 days later, on May 11th, official commemoration of the bicentennial of the Day of Discovery was held at the Columbia River Maritime Museum. Local Big Fish made solemn accolades to Robert Gray and the Boston men. The chairman of the museum board dressed up as Captain Gray, and the replica of Gray's earlier ship, Lady Washington, visited Astoria for the ceremonies. A shock sometimes to realize how small the great exploring ships were. The Washington grounded, however, just off the 17th Street Pier during the ceremony because of a rather swift low tide. And I'd like to end this segment of the program with a poem by Linda Lesowski, Columbia Epic. "Mind the surf," said Captain Gray, his sailors draped like dying birds across the rail. "It's not the lullaby you think. Out here the breakers rise, 3 houses high. The drop is deeper than God's frown, scratched hard into the bottom sand, bejeweled with rusted cups and sailors' skeletons. Shoals stretch their rubber mouths a foot below the foam." And then he raised his sail. And that was Columbia Epic by Linda Lesowski. So this first segment was the first mention of 1992. This second segment will be the second mention. And it's something I wrote, so my disclaimer still holds. And I call it Angel City's Lesson. A college party in Los Angeles that was attended by primarily black University of Southern California students was raided a few days ago. 80 L.A. police in riot gear surrounded the party house. Attendees were handcuffed, detained, and many arrested. The complaint was too much noise, but a party across the street with mostly white USC students was not disturbed. The outcry was immense. In an attempt to defray criticism, a huge meeting was held at the university. Yet when a police commander asked the hundreds of students at the meeting if they thought the party bust was race-based, virtually everyone raised a hand in assent. One white woman who attended the party across the street asked why the cops hadn't busted it and said she was sick of the prevalent racism of the police. She and others repeatedly mentioned the infamously deadly and destructive South Central L.A. race riot of 1992, which occurred these same weeks of May, 21 years ago. USC is located in South Central Los Angeles, surrounded by black and Hispanic neighborhoods that were at the center of the 1992 riot, and before that, the August 1965 Watts riot. The riot broke out on April 29, 1992, in response to the acquittal of 4 L.A. policemen for beating a black man named Rodney King. They nearly clubbed him to death, but a jury that included one or more L.A. cops gave them a pass. A shout of protest rose up throughout the country by both whites and blacks. A videotape of the beating was shown worldwide. In both the Watts and South Central L.A. riots, crowds rampaged the first couple of nights, randomly burning and looting, followed by shooting. Police and the National Guard responded with heavy firepower. Firemen were attacked and forced to avoid fires because of violence and the incapacity to respond to so many. Entire city blocks were on fire in both Watts in 1965 and Central L.A. in 1992. And similarly, non-black owned or operated liquor stores and other businesses in the black community were torched and looted. I was a young reporter at Watts. which at the time was the most severe outbreak of public insurrection since the Civil War. Exposure to such mass rage and violence is terrifying, whether you feel sympathy or abhor it. The intensity, the inward turning of this rage, even as it lashes out randomly, is like eating your own liver, as a friend expresses it. The howl that roars from the crowd, a huge shriek of pain despite the individual epithets of anger. In Watts and Central L.A., 27 years later, crowds of blacks mauled and torched their own neighborhoods, inflicting destruction and homelessness upon themselves and their neighbors, most of whom were trapped within the hysteria. Police fired into crowds of looters and other gatherings of blacks. National Guard jeeps armed with 50-caliber machine guns answered sniper fire by demolishing the house or section of building the shooting came from. The Watts riot was more contained in area than the South Central violence, though it reached far enough to threaten my Sicilian grandmother, who lived near a few torched buildings on Avalon Boulevard outside Watts, but close to primarily black Compton. She and my aunt, who lived with her, were evacuated to my parents' home near Pasadena. The death toll of mainly black American citizens killed by police and National Guardsmen in 1992 greatly exceeded Watts, and in both instances, at least twice as many, and probably more, were killed as were officially proclaimed. So many blacks were dead, wounded, and otherwise injured during Watts that city parks became temporary morgues and hospitals, and prisoner booking facilities were set up in the parks because of the overflow of arrested black persons. Many black Marines I knew in Vietnam the following year were arrested at Watts and given the choice of jail or, quote, service to their country, unquote. It was dangerous to be a white reporter at Watts, which limited coverage to the perspective of the police, whose presence was the only protection. The great fear of everybody during Watts, and surely also in 1992, was the possibility of a white backlash from the surrounding suburbs, which would most likely ignite a bloody race war. My memories of Watts overlap my impressions of the South Central insurrection of 21 years ago, which has replaced Watts, Detroit 1967, and Liberty City, Florida, as the worst riot in the United States in the past century, which includes the horrific Chicago riot of 1919. All of them flared as a result of treatment by police. White-dominated police forces act in black communities as if they are foreign occupying armies. Most of the time, as Jefferson understood in the Declaration of Independence, people patiently suffer the iron heel. But an excessive act, such as the acquittal of policemen who savagely beat a black man, can be the final indignity which erupts in thermonuclear reaction. It is terrible to witness. An optimistic prospect that a riot acts as a wake-up call for society to repair a multitude of gross injustices is a premise that usually dissipates in unbroken promises, just as after both Watts and South Central. The most common aftermath of such riots is finger-pointing among political and legal authorities. The story of the United States is the struggle between white and black, which was at the core of our Civil War 150 years ago. Social programs, even those whose success might resist racist demolishment of social spending, are of little help until the nation as a whole resolves the bitter enmity between blacks and whites. Rob Sawyer wrote in an article for the May 1992 issue of the North Coast Times-Eagle, "Angels have descended on Los Angeles and shown us what happens when power consolidates in the hands of a few and is abused. Now it is up to us to, as Rodney King would say, to work it out." And that was a quote from Rob Sawyer, who wrote a lot of stories for the Times-Eagle during the years I published it. And that was a piece I wrote. And again, the disclaimer, it's my opinion, perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos, but I doubt it. And I guess I, on this really nicely turned sunny morning in May, would, before I close up, say Happy Discovery Day on Saturday, Happy Mother's Day on Sunday.